This is the Medic Cast, May 28th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the MedicCast episode 68. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I want to thank everybody for picking up the show. Happy Memorial Day weekend for those of you that are getting this right away on Monday. I hope your long holiday weekend in the U.S. has turned into a good one for you and your family, and you were able to get out and do the things you wanted to do this holiday weekend. And for everybody else, we're getting solidly here into the summertime in my area, and we're seeing a lot of motor vehicle accidents and things as the kids start to get out of college and get ready to get out of high school. And so we're going to be touching on some of the things to deal with that. Later on in the podcast, I'll be handling spinal immobilization from the National Registry skill sheets, both involving seated spinal immobilization using a shortboard or a KED, and also longboard supine spinal immobilization as well. So we'll be covering that as well as charcoal as the med of the week. All of that here on this great episode. So stay tuned. If you're a brand new listener, welcome to the show and make sure you check out the website at medicast.com and it'll give you a good sense of exactly what the MedicCast is all about. Check out old episodes and check out all the other posts and information that I provide there on the website. I think you will enjoy and be informed by what you find. As far as listener mail this week, I got a couple of interesting items to discuss. First of all, I got an email from listener Chris, who was asking me a question about some of the things that I do on my website and perhaps some information on how to help him with something website-wise that he was working on. And I just wanted to let you guys know, I'm certainly willing to answer questions about anything that I might be doing here at the MedicCast, not just related to EMS, but anything that you might be, you know, maybe you're starting a website for your company or you're interested in starting your own blog. I would certainly be willing to at least point you in the right direction. I am by no means an expert website designer. In fact, most of what I've done with off-the-shelf, in most cases, free software, and set up through my GoDaddy account. So if you have any questions like that, feel free to send them my way. I hope I was able to help Chris out, at least in part, with what he was asking, and I can certainly do the same. I think the more that we create a presence for ourselves online, the more opportunities we have to teach our public what we're doing and to share information between our own selves. So I look forward to helping out with those kind of things as well as needed. I also got an email from a listener regarding interest in some sort of an ALS for BLS tip of the week or class that would share with BLS providers some of the ways that they can assist ALS providers with care during critical transports, times when the ALS provider is really focused on ALS care and focusing on the next treatment that they're going to need to provide in a hurry for a rapidly deteriorating patient. Often, these are the times when a BLS provider can be really that extra pair of hands, that extra set of eyes to keep track of things. And I'm going to touch on this maybe in a future episode and maybe even put something a little extra together for it, because this is something I strongly believe in. Here in my own department, I really work hard to train all the BLS providers in our department to focus on learning some skills that can easily assist ALS providers. Things like spiking an IV bag and getting the line bled out so it's ready to go for the IV. Things like getting the ALS supplies out in line of electrodes or things like that. I mean, anybody can learn the basic positioning of electrodes. Some ALS providers aren't comfortable with that, but I think that that is something that if someone is appropriately trained to do, it's one less step you need to worry about. You can focus on starting an IV while someone else hooks the heart monitor up. You can verify placement visually and then look at the monitor and you can get a sense of what's going on. It'll save you a few minutes that might be critical minutes in care for a patient. So all of these things I'm going to focus on maybe in a future episode, and I'll have more on that in the future. If you have any questions or ideas for things that you'd like to see on the Medicast in the future, make sure you get them to me by email. Well, I think I'm going to jump right on into this week's meat of the show. First of all, the link of the week this week. And the link of the week is a day in the life photo essay where a journalist actually followed one of us around during their day as an EMS provider and provided a photo essay of the time that they spent with this provider. So it's an interesting link, and it might be something you might want to link to on your company websites or something like that to help people in your community learn a little bit more about what EMS sees in the field. You can also maybe use this as an idea to springboard your own photo essay or that day in the life of one of your own providers and provide that on your website or as a part of your services to show your community what you do. So I think this is a great link of the week, and I wanted to put it out there for everybody to take a look at. Okay, the first item in the news this week is an item that I think is going to stir up quite a bit of controversy, and it's certainly going to be a study that's going to need to be replicated many times before I think medical science accepts it as fact, because it is counterintuitive. And this is a study that came out of UCLA that is revealing that it's possible that giving patients pure oxygen is actually causing harm to their brains. And maybe not harm to their brains when they're otherwise healthy in many ways, but maybe harm to their brains when they're in a critical situation and could use some of the power and control over body systems that the brain activates during critical situations, such as how to compensate for shock. What this research did was looking at the differences between inhaling pure oxygen, as in when we bag somebody with 100% O2 at, 15 liters per minute, or if we give them a non-rebreather mask with 15 liters per minute running, the quote-unquote pure oxygen flow. And what this is doing is, according to this study, actually causing some parts of the brain to react strangely. They did this by giving oxygen to the brains of healthy children between the ages of 8 and 15. While they inhaled oxygen, they actually had a brain scan. They actually had a functional magnetic resonance image of their brains that showed what parts of their brains were being activated at any given time. What they found was that when the children inhaled the pure oxygen, their breathing increased, and they rapidly blew off a lot of the carbon dioxide in their body. The drop in the carbon dioxide narrowed blood vessels, and it actually restricted some of the oxygen flow to the parts of the brain and the heart. Then the brain structures began to react to this perceived lack of oxygen. The hippocampus in the brain actually caused parts of the brain to begin reacting strongly. It increased heart rate. It caused hormonal outflows to cascade a series of reactions and potentially harmful chemical releases into the brain and the bloodstream and the body in general. This is opposed to administering 100% oxygen with 10% carbon dioxide. So 90% oxygen, not 100%, but 90% oxygen. And when they administered 90% oxygen to these healthy kids, none of these side effects were seen during the MRI scan of the brain. So this is going to be something we're going to have to look at because, we get hammered into us oxygen, oxygen, oxygen. And I'm a big proponent of giving oxygen to patients to maybe assist them in managing all kinds of things, just because I think that a little oxygen won't hurt. And in the situation where you're putting a nasal cannula on somebody, that's probably not going to cause too much of an issue. But when we move up to the point where we're administering 100% O2 at, say, 15 liters per minute via non-rebreather mask or via bag valve mask, we may in fact be causing some harm to the patient by administering them 100% oxygen rather than high flow oxygen with some carbon dioxide or other atmospheric gases mixed in. So this study's going to have to look a little deeper. I think we're going to have to revisit this many times, but it's something for all of us to keep an eye on and kind of keep in the back of our minds while we're treating critical patients. Moving along, for those of you who've been following the ongoing trials for the different blood substitutes that are out there and going on right now, the polyheme product is probably one of the most well-known blood substitutes that was recently tested in 20 cities nationwide on victims of severe traumas, car crashes, shootings, and other trauma. The controversy that came up in the past over this was the fact that it was considered unethical by some researchers to proceed in this fashion because the patients had no ability to have some kind of consent over participating in the trial, and that the trial was in fact withholding whole blood from these patients in favor of using the blood substitute when it was in fact known that whole blood was the life-saving treatment that was needed. And we've talked about this in the past. I've covered this on episodes of the Medicast News. I think I've covered it here in the Medicast as well. And as these studies completed and they moved into the analysis phase of the different studies, there has come up that there's an investigation involving 46 deaths among the 349 subjects who received polyheme during the clinical trial period. Now, 35 of the 363 patients who were given standard treatment, i.e. whole blood, died. And this is a difference that is considered significant by some and may or may not be significant depending on how the analysis is carried out. Now, this is important to understand. Were these patients dying because they would have died regardless of which treatment they got? And based on the number of subjects in the trials on both sides, that the number of deaths is greater, but not significantly so. This is something that they're going to have to look at and maybe have further trials on. But one of the things that we really need to focus on is the need for some kind of a blood substitute. And this is, I'm hopeful that this is something that resolves, whether it's polyheme, whether it's any of the other blood substitutes that are currently in process of development out there. You know, this is not going to be something we're going to use frivolously, but we all know right now that our current field treatment, i.e. normal saline or lactated ringers, the crystalloid solutions that are given to patients, are just not adequate for the needs of the patients we give them to. We really need to have some form that carries oxygen in the bloodstream. When a patient is hypovolemic due to hemorrhage, we are not going to be able to sustain them very long, if at all, with boluses of crystalloid solutions. And yet that's what we use right now. And it may be enough to maintain a blood pressure for a short period of time, but what they really need is some replacement fluid that carries oxygen to the body's cells. And we really need to review and hope that this kind of thing is available. Maybe the polyheme isn't the answer. We'll have to find out. But I hope that the research continues on this, because being able to carry some sort of shelf-stable, something that can be stored for a longer period of time than regular blood and can be carried in an ambulance without special refrigeration or special handling, can be hung and distributed to patients in need in the field, is significant. We may stop so many trauma arrests from happening. We may stop battlefield deaths that are occurring right now overseas from happening simply because we have some viable solution to getting fluids into the body that can carry oxygen. So more on this. There's a good article that I found over at EMS Responder with a link in the show notes. Head on over there and read some more about what the study is. There's pros and cons listed there and a lot of information about this particular study and what the controversy currently is over the discrepancy in the number of deaths between the two study groups. Okay, how about a look at some good news on the infectious disease front? You know, for a long time, hepatitis C has kind of been the boogeyman of infectious diseases among healthcare workers. You know, it's the one you can catch from your patients without even knowing you've caught it that can cause you to become debilitated or die, and there is no cure. You get hepatitis C, you're positive for hepatitis C for the rest of your life, right? Well, apparently not. A recent study is showing that hepatitis C infection is not only able to be successfully treated by the recently available antiviral drug therapies, but that hepatitis C patients can actually be effectively cured of the disease. Up to 7 years after treatment in this study, 99% of up to 1,000 successfully treated patients showed no evidence of hepatitis C virus infections. And in fact, of the 8 patients that presented with hepatitis C virus after the fact of the study's conclusions, two of these 8 patients were known to have actually probably recontacted someone with HCV and become reinfected, and it's unknown if the other 6 may also be reinfections rather than relapses. However, this is good news. I mean, 99% cure rate would be an amazing success story for this previously untreatable viral disease. And certainly good news for all of the healthcare providers that treated patients with HCV infections that were not aware they had it and subsequently dropped out of the medical field because of the disease process. So this is really good news. Now, the treatments that are out there right now are a long-term acting version of the drug interferon, as well as an antiviral drug known as ribavirin. And the follow-up study is going to be continued to be followed up on while they look at some more information. The important thing to understand is that only about 50% of the patients treated with these two treatments actually respond well to the treatment. So if you have HCV infection, you can have a 50% chance of being treated successfully. But if that treatment is successful, you have a virtual 100% chance of being completely cured of the disease. And that's certainly a better outlook and prognosis than we had in the recent past for this particular disease process. Finally, as EMS Week wrapped to a close this past Sunday, and all of you had your great EMS Week activities planned for your communities, right? Well, regardless, I hope you were well appreciated by your departments or by your communities in some way. I know here in my area, Union Hospital in Elkton had a luncheon and then a dinner planned with dessert after both, and that was greatly appreciated at the ER this past Wednesday by everybody that was able to get in there and partake of that, and that was put on with some great home-cooked food by many of the nurses at the emergency department there, so thank you very much. And, you know, EMS Week is put together by the American College of Emergency Physicians, and this was the 34th annual EMS Week this past week. Something else that the American College of Emergency Physicians did was to help be instrumental in getting out the first virtual EMS museum that will be out there, and we'll link together approximately 1,000 EMS museums from across the country. This can be found at www.nemsmf.org. And there'll be a link in the show notes so you can go there directly. But we need to know that we're together on this. While there used to be an EMS museum in Roanoke, Virginia at the National EMS Memorial, there was no permanent location for that facility, and the facility they actually had it in was actually had to get rid of the museum as it was sold, I believe. And so all that stuff was packed up and put away until such a time as we can actually get some ground and the funds to build a proper National EMS Museum. But in the meantime, the virtual museum is a great opportunity to view online artifacts and equipment, ambulances, photographs, and other memorabilia of EMS history. And it's something that everybody can take a look at. And again, something else you can link to provide information to your site. So make sure that you head on over and check this out and let them know that you're visiting. Send them your support. Okay, no time like the present to jump right on into this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week I'm going to retouch again on some of the National Registry skills tests that some of you may be finding coming up soon. And this is the spinal immobilization for seated patients and spinal immobilization for supine patients. Generally, you'll probably only have one or the other as a skill station, but it's important that you know both of them because you're not going to know which one you have to do until you get there. I'll start off with some general information on taking these kinds of tests. First of all, make sure you're familiar with the equipment in the room. You have an opportunity when you walk into the room where the skill station is to inspect the equipment to make sure it's what you're used to using. And if it's not, to have a reasonable explanation of its use if it's different from what you're currently being trained to use. And this is one of those situations where maybe in your jurisdiction, you don't use quick clip straps, you use a 9-foot strap. And so you want to familiarize yourself with how the quick clip straps work. You want to, maybe you use duct tape. That is certainly a viable way to secure somebody to a backboard. And if you're going to use that kind of technology, then you need to make sure that it's something that you have available at the test site. And test sites will generally accommodate reasonable requests for equipment if you're not familiar with the equipment they provide. So once you've inspected the equipment, and of course, when you inspect the equipment, if all that's in the room is a longboard, guess what you're doing when you get there? You're going to be doing supine immobilization. And if all that's in the room is a shortboard, a halfboard, or a KED, then that's likely to be what you use. Once you get done with that, your inspection time, you'll then tell the person you're ready to go, and you'll generally have a person to actually act as your patient on the board. You'll start your process of immobilizing the patient. Make sure you take your time, and the most important thing to do after they say go is to take a deep breath. That's it. Just calm yourself down, take a deep breath, and then move on into it. You guys have practiced on this. There's no substitute for actually getting hands-on and practicing again and again and again and again until you're comfortable with it. But you can certainly use this as well to help you visualize success during the testing process. For spinal immobilization for the seated patient, we're going to go ahead and start there. You will first of all verbalize and or take body substance isolation precautions. So you're going to do your scene safety, your BSI. You know, if you've listened to the show, that I advocate putting on gloves at the beginning of the day and not taking them off till you've finished your last test, because this will hopefully save you if you forget to say this, but you still should remember to say it. You're then going to have an assistant there that will follow your instructions. You'll direct the assistant to place and maintain the head in a neutral inline position. You're going to then direct your assistant to maintain manual immobilization of the head. This is important. Make sure you tell them not to let go for any reason. If they, for some reason, do let go, you've instructed them not to. Make sure you're looking at the instructor, the preceptor, when you say that you've said, I'm telling them not to let go until I tell them to. So if for some reason they let go, it's not on you. You want to quickly assess the patient's motor, sensory, and circulatory function in all four extremities. You want to apply an appropriate sized extrication collar. You're going to then position the immobilization device behind the patient. This is the KED or the half backboard. Get it in place correctly behind the patient. You'll secure the device to the patient's torso. You'll evaluate that the torso is appropriately attached and adjust that attachment as necessary. And you'll then make sure that you evaluate all of the pads behind the patient's head. It's really important that the patient be in a neutral inline position. So you want to make sure you adequately pad behind the patient's head so that when you secure the headboard, you're not actually craning the head back away from the neck. In other words, you want the body in that neutral position. So you want to make sure the padding is appropriate, and then you want to go ahead and secure the patient's head to the device. You're then going to verbalize moving the patient to a long backboard, and then you are going to reassess motor, sensory, and circulatory function in each extremity. Now, you're going to have to familiarize yourself with whatever device you use. I could do a thing here on how to use the KED. Remember, the body straps go on middle, bottom, top. You then want to check to make sure that it's tight enough, that they don't move around, that the patient's appropriately attached to this device, but you really need to go out there and familiarize yourself with the device that's being used in your particular testing location. And if you're traveling to a testing location, contact the person involved in testing and ask them which devices they use for this particular test, or will they provide you a range of devices? That's certainly a reasonable question. You know, are they using 9-foot straps? Do they have quick clip straps? Do they have, you know, what are they using? So you need to familiarize yourself with that. Here's the critical criteria for the supine patient and spinal immobilization. You do any of these or fail to do any of these steps and you are automatically failed. You did not immediately direct or take manual stabilization of the head. You released or ordered the release of the manual immobilization before it was maintained mechanically. You manipulated the patient or moved them excessively, causing a spinal compromise. The device may be moved excessively up, down, left, or right on the patient's torso. And again, this goes back to making sure it's attached securely to the torso first, that the head is properly immobilized and that there's not excessive movement. You want to make sure that the torso fixation is not so tight as to inhibit chest rise, resulting in respiratory compromise. You want to make sure that upon the completion of your immobilization, the head is still in an inline neutral position. You also want to make sure that you remember to assess your pulse, motor, and sensory function in the extremities before you start and after you're completely finished, that you voice that immobilization. You've immobilized into the longboard. You're going to go ahead and vocalize or actually check pulse, motor, and sensory function in all extremities. And finally, the biggie is if you immobilize the head before you immobilize the torso to the board, you are going to fail. So that's the seated patient for the spinal immobilization part of the NREMT test. Let's move on into the supine patient. Many of these steps are very similar, and many of the fail points, critical fail points, are also similar, but it is slightly different. First of all, scene safety BSI, you're going to direct your assistant again to place the head and maintain it in a neutral inline position, and you're going to direct them to maintain manual immobilization until you specifically tell them to let go. You're then going to reassess your motor, sensory, and circulatory function in each extremity. And when you do these things, you make sure you verbalize it. First of all, by talking to yourself out loud, if you get in the habit of doing that while you're listening to this or when you're actually practicing, you'll get in the habit of doing it in the station. And you can then do one more step to make sure that the instructor's watching. Maybe they look down to jot something down on the paper and they missed you doing a key point here. So you want to make sure you verbalize as you go along everything you're doing. You're then going to size and appropriately apply an extrication C-collar. You're going to position your immobilization device correctly. In this case, you'll have the patient on the ground and you'll be laying the backboard next to them. You'll then engage in helping to move the patient, roll them in line so that they can be moved onto the device without compromising any spinal integrity. So you're going to direct movement of the patient onto the backboard. You can do this by the scissoring motion that you learn in a lot of trauma classes, basically putting the backboard a little off center, basically up the body so the patient's feet are hanging over the end. When you roll them onto it, they're mostly on the backboard, and then you can, as a group, lift and slide the patient up into position directly in the center of the board, all the way on the board appropriately. You can apply then padding to any voids between the torso and the board as necessary. Remember to pay attention to areas like the small of the back and the bottom back of the knees. You'll then immobilize the patient's torso to the device using the supplied materials, and then you'll evaluate and pad behind the patient's head as necessary. This is probably not going to be an issue as much with your patients in the testing scenario, but it's something to always remember for patients like elderly adults with curvature of the spine. But you want to make sure that the head is still in an inline position. And if it isn't, you want to lift the head up a little bit, maybe put some padding back there. You're then going to, once everything's immobilized below the shoulders, you're going to go ahead and immobilize the patient's head to the device. You'll secure their arms and legs. You'll secure the securing the patient's legs and feet to the device and the patient's arms to the device so that they will not slide up or down on the board when they're secured. You'll then, again, finally reassess pulse, motor, and sensory function in each extremity and verbalize everything you do as you go. Again, critical criteria, if you don't immediately get C-spine under control and make sure that the person understands not to let go, if you let go early, if you, as far as spinal immobilization of the C-spine, you want to make sure that the patient is not excessively moved or manipulated when you put them on the long backboard. You want to make sure the patient isn't going to move up or down, left or right on the device. This may involve using blanket rolls to pad the patient side to side to keep them in place. You want to make sure that you have adequate head immobilization so that they can't move their head or neck very easily because of the way you've immobilized it. And again, you want to make sure that upon completion, the head is in a neutral position. It is okay to reposition the collar on these patients. So make sure you double check. Stand directly in front of them. Make sure that chin button is right under the chin, that the collar is sized appropriately. And if you need to make a change, make it. I mean, they may fail you depending on the instructor, but if you don't do it, they're definitely going to fail you. But give yourself an opportunity to fix something. It's okay to notice, in most cases, something that's wrong and fix it. Once you're done, you want to make sure you reassess pulse, motor, or sensory function, or again, if you don't reassess that, that's a fail point. And again, anytime you immobilize the head before you immobilize the torso, it's a fail point. Remember, torso first, because if you immobilize the head first and the body moves, you're just going to snap their neck. So that's why you have somebody manually stabilizing the C-spine, because if the body were to, let's say the patient started to move off the board and slid off the board for some reason, maybe you're on a slope where you're doing this, you have somebody there that can keep the neck and C-spine in line with the rest of the body. So again, this is the spinal immobilization stations for the National Registry exams, and it's something for you all to kind of practice on. So I hope you're able to listen to this. Remember to stay calm, take a deep breath, and relax. When you relax and take that deep breath, it allows your brain a chance to just reset and go ahead into test mode, where you're just kind of relaxed and going through these steps. You guys know this stuff. You've been practicing it. It's just a question of going through the testing situation. So that's the supine immobilization for the National Registry test. Well, the tip and trick of the week's done, and it's time to move into this week's Med of the Week. And this week, I thought I would revisit activated charcoal. I put a couple of posts up recently and have some more coming up in the future on different poisonings that have been handed out in newsletters by the Maryland Poison Control Service. And I thought I would touch a little bit more on activated charcoal as a treatment in the field. Activated charcoal actually has a long history in medicine, and it dates back to 1831, where at the French Academy of Medicine, Professor Thuary drank a lethal dose of strychnine in front of his colleagues and then quickly chased it with activated charcoal, proving that the activated charcoal was effective in combating poisons. Well, I'm not advocating any kind of stuff like that, and it certainly goes against most scientists' views of how to prove their product works. But anyway, that's an interesting finding on how the activated charcoal entered the realm of emergency medicine. But it is obviously and widely accepted as the most effective treatment for decontamination of the GI tract after ingestion of poisons. It is considered to be the single most effective agent that we have currently available to us. Activated charcoal is estimated to reduce up to 60% of poisonous substances that are currently being absorbed by the body in the GI tract. And it works by soaking up the chemicals using active bonding sites chemically on the carbon molecules. It reduces the toxicity, therefore, because that chemical no longer is available to be absorbed into the body, and it will eventually pass through the body with the charcoal itself and excreted. Activated charcoal is a fine black powder that in the field is mixed in tubes with some fluids, water. Sometimes it has a flavoring agent added, although the stuff looks pretty nasty. I can't imagine that the flavoring is going to make that much difference in how it works. Used to be that stomach pumping was the most effective way to treat at least was thought to be an adjunct to activated charcoal. But unlike stomach pumping or gastric lavage, activated charcoal will work on into the rest of the GI tract, whereas the gastric lavage really only works in the upper GI area of the stomach. So beyond that, what do we do and what do we use activated charcoal for? Well, again, indications for activated charcoal include poisoning by mouth. You may also want to be aware that there may be adverse effects, primarily that the person drinking the activated charcoal may gag or begin to vomit because they're drinking the activated charcoal. Some people don't react well to drinking substances that they don't want to drink or don't like the taste of. You want to make sure that you're taking appropriate precautions because activated charcoal will not absorb everything. It's only going to be about 60% of the poisonous substances that'll be taken up by activated charcoal. So you want to make sure you're consulting for this particular med. Consult with your local poison control center. If you have it in your phone, you can call that directly, or you can use your med radios if you have access to that where you are. You also want to make sure you understand whether you can take orders from poison control directly or whether those orders have to be relayed through medical command. In Maryland, you do have to relay all orders with medical command. I am able to bring up poison control and my medical control center at the same time on the radio. I basically describe what I have going on with my patient, the presentation, the history, and then usually poison control will rapidly come back with a recommendation, and generally the ER accepts that recommendation and then maybe adds on other treatments as necessary. It is contraindicated in patients with altered mental status and in anybody who's received any kind of emetic agent or an agent that will cause somebody to vomit. We don't use Ipecac anymore in my area, and I think it's pretty much gone out of style in most of the United States. However, somebody may have Ipecac at home, and they may think that's the way to take care of this problem. So you need to make sure you get a quick and good history. Did you take anything to treat this yet? And you'll find out if they've taken the Ipecac, and then you want to let people know about that. But that's probably going to be a contraindication of administering the activated charcoal. Preparations come in a variety of forms, but generally the initial dose is, at least in the way it's packaged, is 25 to 50 grams in one single package in a prepared solution. And the dose here in Maryland is 1 gram per kilogram. So you may, in an adult patient who maybe weighs 100 kilograms, need to be prepared to at least start them down the road of getting 100 grams of this solution on board. So that's something to kind of be aware of as well. Remember that you need to get a good history. You need to know what the substance is that was ingested. You need to know a time frame. So you need to go through your sample history quickly with the patient or with a bystander who's aware of what's going on and make sure you find out exactly how much they took as best as possible and an approximate time frame, how long ago, because all of this may affect how they're treated by you in the field and subsequently in the emergency department, as some things are more rapidly absorbed than others, and it may be too late to administer the activated charcoal. It may already have been starting to have an effect on the patient, and the activated charcoal would not be indicated. Either way, activated charcoal is at a long-standing use for treatment of poisonings, and it's one of the things that's in our bag of tricks, and it's this week's MedicCast Med of the Week. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show. Remember, you can get in touch with me. Send me your comments, your questions, your corrections if I've made a mistake. Because, hey, you know, I'm not perfect, guys. And this is a team effort. So if there's something I've said in the show that's not correct, please let me know so I can correct it and get all of the proper information out to everybody. You can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can go directly to the website at medicast.com, and you can leave comments there in the show notes. You can leave comments after any entry on the MedicCast blog. And once you leave one comment there and it's approved, you can go back anytime you want and leave other comments as you wish to other things without having to wait to do so. You just have to log into the site and get access directly that way. You can also reach me at the Medicast voicemail line at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. And you can reach me directly there. Leave a message on the voicemail line for me. And at the very end, like, make sure you remember to leave your email address. I'll clip it out if I include your voicemail in the show, but it gives me a way to reach you if I have some comments that I think you might appreciate directly and immediately. And if you want to, you can leave me even a phone number to reach you, and I'll be happy to call you if I can find the time. But generally, email is the best way for me to get back to you. Finally, if you want more information brought to you on a regular basis from the Medicast, if you like getting the links to the show notes sent directly to your email address, then sign up for the Medicast newsletter. By signing up for the newsletter, you will get regular updates on when the shows are posted. You'll get copies of the show notes emailed directly to you, and you'll also get other updates as they come available. I don't sell that information. It doesn't belong to anybody else. It just comes in directly from me. I don't send out a lot of them, but probably 5 or 6 a month, you'll get copies of the newsletter updates for the different podcasts, as well as getting a information and a special tip of the week in the show notes for Medicast newsletter subscribers. Just a little extra tip that I try to throw your way for being signed up for the newsletter. It's absolutely free. Head on over to medicast.com, and in the upper right-hand corner of the blog, you'll see a link to sign up for the newsletter. Go ahead and do that and become a member of the Medicast newsletter group. Without further ado, I'll wrap up as I always do by adding some great PodSafe music. Again, this week from the PodSafe Music Network, which can be found over at music.podshow.com. You can head over there and find a lot of great independent music in a variety of different categories by many great artists out there. Some of the music's available for download for inexpensive purposes, or if you find an artist over there you like a lot of times, as in today's artist, you can actually find their music over at the iTunes store. And there's actually a link today, as there often is, for the iTunes store link for the artist today. Today I'm going to have music by an artist by the name of Will Tang, and Will has a great song called Everything Changes, which I think is appropriate as we wrapped up EMS week this past week. EMS has come a long way since the very first EMS week 34 years ago, and I think it has a long way to go, and it's exciting to be part of those ongoing changes in the emergency medical services field. So with his great song, Will Tang, with the song Everything Changes, I'm going to go ahead and leave you with that. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
I know love is it, gonna keep it warm, holding you in my arms. Not there but never gone, some things you gotta hold on. Said nothing's wrong, I'm just traveling on. Is it really any wonder it's not the same? Changing with time. Feels so right and I don't care, thinking about when you were there. You know, not know, never let it go. Do you remember when back then, taking our time, living day by day.